Easy E, how are we?
Feeling good, Shawnee. Feeling good.
Well, I hope a lot of people listening to this podcast can be feeling good too, because two big events this weekend. I've got myself doing Hellevation, and there's a good few people, a good few guests that have been on this podcast are doing Hellevation as well this weekend. But I'm assuming a lot of people listening are also doing Quest and Glendalough. So big weekend for events.
Yeah, Quest and Glendalough. I don't think I've ever had a good day at that race.
I think you probably had one of your worst days when we did that 2 years ago. But there is a podcast episode we did where we kind of went to review on that. I can't remember because it was 2 years ago, but I imagine it's just you going, yeah, that was shit. Yeah, that was shit. I didn't like that hill either. Yeah, that was shit.
that was near-death experience, that one for me. But out of stupidity, doing things when you're sick. Anyway, I still sometimes don't learn, but I did. I took a big life lesson that day. It's a challenge. It is what it says in the tin. Like it's a tough race. It's a great race. It's a great challenge because I could never tell you what time I did it in. Where, you know, like in the terms of a race, you know, I think it's a great challenge. Great physical challenge for people to do, and those who have signed up for it or are doing it with friends and stuff, very best of luck. It's something that you will learn something about yourself, good, bad, or indifferent on the other end, and that's what it's all about, really.
Yeah, no, and the scenes and stuff in Glendalough, my God, it's pretty cool. Not so much you're going up the hill, but when you are flying down that hill, do take your time. I don't know if that's good advice, actually, have a look at it all then, maybe when you're doing the running instead, but like there's parts where, especially doing it for the first time, you're like, oh my God, 6K run. It's not really a run unless you're Ricky Wynn elite level at that stage, because you turn that corner, you see that big hill going up. A lot of people are just marching up that hill. I don't mean just, but like the majority of people are marching up that hill and just trying to get through it.
Yeah, it is one of those. And it's just about getting through. It's just about holding on for dear life, essentially, at times. But no, a really, really good experience. And a good challenge for people. There's a couple of different levels as well. So for those who are taking on the advanced sporty level, best of luck. It's a tough course. It's a long course. And those who are just dipping their toe this time are in for a really, really good challenge and a good day out. And it's a good little town. Lara's a good little place. It's a nice food place and stuff. They'll be busy and stuff, but it is a great event. And as you said, it's beautiful. Even the drive there and back is beautiful. So do enjoy the day and make the day of it.
Yeah, the cutoffs are very lenient as well, I think. So you're going to be doing it between 2 and 7 hours, 10 minutes, what are you doing it? Hopefully, I'll be running a little bit longer than 7 hours this Saturday. I'm not too confident on that, but we'll see how that goes as well with the Hellevation Challenge. But I really don't want to touch any more on that, to be honest with you. Otherwise, I'll psych myself out in the podcast. We all know the goal is 24 hours. The attempt once this Saturday. You said you're feeling good to start a podcast. I'm going to segue into that. Why are you feeling so good?
Good because it's my last physio session has happened. It's been absolutely an excellent experience for me learning about my body as well. Like a lot of times I've gone to the physio before, it's because I have had an issue here, and the minute it even gets to 80%, I'm like, thanks, see it, bye, and I'm gone again. Whereas this one I committed to. I feel like a broken record. I said it every week, the kind of process of getting myself aligned and fixed up. And like today was a day spent on basically for myself to learn what lactic acid feels like on a muscle versus what muscle tiredness feels with through massage and stuff. And
what do you mean by that?
So it's just the feeling. So like the way he was describing it was like he'd rub the side of my calf and he's like, okay, do you feel this? And he'd say, close your eyes and feel. And he's pushing and he's like, what do you feel? It's like it's jelly moving up my leg. It's like, yes, that's lactic acid. And then you go to the center of the calf and you go, what does this feel like? I was like, it just feels like my muscles are sore. And he was like, yeah, it's just tiredness in the muscles. So just even that alone, getting to experience that different feelings and where the deposits are building up on my body and where they're probably building up for too long and turning a little bit toxic. And he just went into this. I got an education today and it was good. And it was kind of the final check off. My range of motion is good. Sciatica isn't an issue for me really anymore. My posture is a lot better. When you look at me in a photograph, my hips aren't, I don't look like I'm the Leaning Tower of Pisa anymore. I'm square on. And overall, I'm ready to really push back into the training and stuff and should be able to operate over. But it's something I'm going to keep as part of my training. once a month, a check-in, you know, with someone who knows what they're looking at, knows the difference between lactic acid and sore muscles, and knows that I'm not willing to come off a training plan. It's, you know, someone who's able to kind of help, you know, steer the ship and make sure we're still operating injury free. So it's something that a couple of guests have said, and Wayne has said, you know, to add in recovery element. And we sit front row to all these great guests. We have to start listening to some of them. And if that doesn't convince you, our next guest, Sean, will 100% convince people of it.
This our next guest of the podcast, and I butchered the intro because she's done so much. I try to do it right, so I'm just going to kick straight into this week's episode of the podcast with Aisling Lacey. Let's go. So this week on the Any Given Run Day podcast, we have PhD student in the School of Health and Human Performance at DCU and Insight, which are Science Foundation Ireland Research Centre for Data Analytics, as well as a certified athletic therapist and a converted runner. Aisling Lacey, welcome to this week's episode of the Any Given Run Day podcast. How are you getting on?
Hi, lads. I'm good. Thank you. Thanks a million for having me on.
Don't thank him. Every time you say you're gonna do a good intro, you absolutely butter it.
That was like 7-8 lines of stuff Aisling had. Could y'all just be like just Insight Science Foundation Ireland and that's it? But no, Aisling has to get certified like therapist in. She's got to be PhD with health and human performance. She's a converted runner. She's doing the half marathon in June. There's so much to get into that intro. It's just so much to get through, but.
Aisling, does your email footer look like alphabet soup, does it?
Not yet. Maybe give me 3 months until I get that doctorate.
The last couple of weeks of this podcast, and it's a little bit annoying on my end, the number one question we've had is, who is Eric's human mechanic for his NCT? Because he keeps talking about having this NCT to fix niggles and stuff. And you talk about Niggle City and the running injury continuum. What is Niggle City?
I suppose from what we found in our study, runners say that they live in Niggle City and they're constantly there. They constantly have these niggles and they're just part of running and they accept it and they're kind of nearly content with accepting niggles as a part of running. But kind of what we found is that niggles are probably on something that we've called this running injury continuum. And they probably lead to more serious injuries. So really, they kind of shouldn't be ignored. So we want to get runners out of Niggle City as much as we can and into that like running smooth kind of section.
I didn't think I had a mortgage, but I definitely had a mortgage in Niggle City before I went for the NCT anyway.
Yeah.
That's one thing we've realized. And for me, it was a big thing. I didn't realize, okay, Sean will laugh, how much was wrong with me until I actually went to a professional and said, how much is actually wrong with me and where is it coming from? Mm-hmm. It's scary to, when you said that sentence, I had actually gone, yeah, that's, I have been living that life for a long time.
It's funny how just acceptable they are. And runners expect to be in pain when they run and expect things to be sore, but you know, pain is an abnormal thing, really. So we want to kind of address it as best we can.
You did a talk in the Science of Running Symposium on runners' perspective on injuries. Before I clicked the YouTube video to watch it, I was like, how are you getting 14 minutes out of this? Because like, are we injured? Yes. Are we going to run? Yes or no? And that's pretty much it. But you have this spectrum of different levels, like it goes from running smooth, which no one listens to this podcast is pain free and running smooth, and then just different areas, some discomfort, niggle, twinges, and it goes along the line, but you have different managements for it. The one I'm interested near the start, because we're all near the start, is you have like self-management. One of them is stretching and a rest day. I don't know what rest day is. I guess you'll find that later, but stretching, do you find that works?
From a personal point of view, I do. I think there's an art like would kind of stretch, I suppose, pre-session, post-session. So I think from a personal point of view, I like stretching. I don't do it a huge amount, to be honest, only when I train. I wouldn't really stretch when I don't train. But from a research perspective, there's not a huge amount to support stretching and preventing injuries. Things like stretching is important when there's a reduction in like muscle flexibility. So stretching is appropriate then, but it depends on the type of stretching you do, where you want to stretch, how long you're going to stretch for, when you're going to stretch. So there's a huge amount of things to kind of take into consideration when research-wise it's not hugely supported. And that was probably one thing we found, that runners put a huge emphasis on stretching, and it's nearly the gold standard for preventing injuries. Like, they think if they don't stretch, like, they're injured, or like they're going to get injured basically. But research-wise, there's not a huge amount to support it, which is interesting. Yeah.
Do you find there's a conflict between your thoughts of, I feel better when I stretch before or after run, therefore I do it, and then you look at research, it's like, but it doesn't really prove it, but I feel better. Is there something to feeling better that is a positive thing, or is it just like, this, there's not much to something like this working?
No, I think I think there's definitely a positive. If people can get a subjective relief from something, I think do it. And I think as a clinician, you know, I try to use an evidence-based practice as much as you can. So having your practice guided by evidence, but you also have to treat the real person in front of you. And if they find stretching helpful, I think I would encourage them to stretch. Like, saying that no matter if the research doesn't support it, I think if they find it beneficial and they can get a relief from it, do it.
Yeah. It's funny because all these times I've been like, I didn't stretch after that run, or I didn't do much. Thank God science has backed me up, but I'm definitely suffering on the lack of flexibility in the muscles, I suppose, is some of the issues I've been having now. And I have found myself stretching a lot over the last 2 weeks as part of my ongoing program to get myself back up to a base. Obviously, there has to be something with the amount of runs or the sitting behind desks. So not necessarily the activity that's causing the injury. It's our whole daily life that's going to restrict muscles or reduce that flexibility. And is that something we need to look at, even though, because a lot of the guests we have, we're not full-time athletes. We are people who work at desks. We're people who are climbing on roofs or fixing things or carpenters. Is that what we need to look at when we're looking ourselves in terms of our injuries and our niggles?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a factor, like, especially like when we sit for such long periods and we're constantly kind of in this like forward position, and then to be able to get yourself out of that and to open your body nearly to run is really hard. If you're constantly in a forward position where you're sitting, your hips are tight, your kind of shoulders are round and forward, to reverse that and get out of it, it can be quite hard when you're not used to it and you spend so long in that forward position. So like, little and often getting up out of the desk, like doing a lap, if you could do even little stretches during the day, it might just help free things up a little bit. Whereas a 10 minute, you know, like if you're sitting for 8 hours a day and then you're in the car for 2 hours, you know, a session of 10 minutes of stretching is going to be hard to try like reverse all of that. So definitely the day-to-day stuff can be hopefully addressed too, to kind of back end all the rehab and injury prevention stuff. Yeah.
I'm going to preface this by saying that in case it's a stupid question, I didn't read it right, that I did a module in strength conditioning on reading scientific papers and stuff like that and be able to read them right. And I bluffed my way through it. So they can't take back my degree now. But what you have 7 publications on researchgate.net. One of them was focusing on injury-focused wearable devices.
Yeah.
Is there a point where you can get like... is this injury prevention through technology? Is there a thing as injury prevention, or like what's the goal there?
So that paper was, we did it to basically get runners' perception of what they would like in a device. So what we're planning in DCU is we're going to develop a study like in the next kind of few months where we're going to recruit really as many runners as we can, and we're going to get them to wear a small like wearable sensor. So it'll be probably on their lower back. And then we have designed a custom app as well that's going to capture loads of different metrics around their training load and their injury risk. So things like how often they train, how hard they train, if they do gym or strength work, then all these kind of niggles and injuries they get, things like their menstrual cycle, their sleep, their stress and work, how they're eating, all these kind of factors. And we hope to monitor that for like at least a year. So using wearable sensors and apps and like technology to capture all of that data and use that then to possibly understand the risk factors for injury. Because we're quite unaware of what really causes injury, bar being previously injured, or quite aggressive spikes in your training load. They're kind of the two things that the research supports the strongest at the minute. But other than that, we're quite unaware of what causes injury. So we hope to look at all of those factors. I've probably forgotten some, but look at all of those and see how they influence risk of injury. And then can we possibly predict injury and maybe interfere to reduce the likelihood of injury?
Can I ask a question about how now you're, it's obviously in a couple of months time, but what decides the location of the sensors? And this, I'm just purely curious, why the lower back and where do you stop on the parameters, you know, of is this as broad as you can make it, as broad as the technology or the app will allow you, or as the subject will put in exactly how much water they had and how much sleep they had? So what are the limits, I suppose, to something like this, and why those specific areas? What does that give you?
Yeah, like I suppose as researchers, we want to get as much as we can, but we obviously have to be really conscious about the burden we put on participants. So we have to balance that between how much data we want to get from them, but actually how much they're going to give us and how much time it's going to take and if they're going to actually engage in using all these things. So the location of the sensor. So look, we'd love to have like sensors all over runners, but that's probably not going to happen, to be honest.
Lord of the Rings on the green screen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So because we're most interested in lower limb injuries, if it's on the lower back, I'm actually not 100% sure on the like specifics of this, but it'll get basically the loading and the impact acceleration. So it'll get basically how hard you strike the ground. The sensor will kind of will pick that up, and we'll hopefully detect changes that if you strike the ground in a different way or strike it harder, are you changing your risk of injury? So the lower back will get that from limb to limb. Ideally, we'd love to put maybe one on each shin, on each tibia. But again, that's having two sensors or three sensors per person. Is that going to happen? So probably more than likely, if we give them one sensor, they're more than likely going to do it. And if that's the case, it'll be on the lower back, because then we'll get left and right, those like impact accelerations.
On one of your other papers, you had you talked about injuries and the main factors being excessive loading. You've talked about on those papers about inadequate recovery, other factors being training activities, injury history, running technique. And I've read other researchers other papers where it's been like mileage, like between like I think 25, 27 miles, something like that, but any more they don't get injured. And I've seen all these different things. But one thing I don't see is how the foot lands with pronation, supination, and what I don't see is running shoes. How much reliance do we, and we're not sponsored by anyone, so and maybe not running shoes after this.
Give us a like, million euros.
How much do we over-rely on, or do we over-rely on different types of runners for that, or does impact have come into it for the type of runners we should or should not be wearing?
Yeah, I think there's a like runners put a huge emphasis on running shoes, and definitely in the clinic, it's one of the things that we talk about most. Are they wearing the right shoes? What shoes, like, should they be wearing? And research wise, again, there's not a huge amount to support one type of shoe over another. One of the biggest things is comfort. So if you find one particular shoe comfortable, wear that shoe. It there's kind of other. Sorry, my Zoom is just.
That's Nike listening.
Yeah. Stop talking now. Stop talking. You're ruining our business.
What was I saying there? Oh, yeah. So like comfort is kind of the biggest thing in relation to running shoes. If you find a shoe comfortable, that's the one you go for. Research like doesn't support one shoe or one type of shoe over the other. But other things that are coming out of the research is like rotating your shoes. So if you change your shoes, say for different sessions or for different surfaces, it can change the loading applied to your body, that you're not constantly being loaded in the same way. That's kind of the argument behind changing shoes, which is starting to be supported by research.
And that's one thing we've seen over, I think one of our previous guests actually mentioned that they change their shoes every so often just to get a different feel and loading on the body. And it's something subconsciously I've started to do. So instead of, I've put X amount of kilometers into these shoes, that's it, they're gone. It's now this shoe's turn to take me through the next six. I've actually kept the older pair for the odd 3K run just to run in them. And it, you know, like, I don't know if it's making a difference, but I feel like there's more comfort in each of them, and I'm not wearing the same ones. And I suppose if I feel good, it's better. But if research is now starting to back it, it's the running sport just got more expensive because now you need to buy two, three different pairs of shoes to get you through a season.
Yeah, it's mad. Yeah. So one other thing popped into my head there while you were talking, and now it's gone out again. But yeah, like,
how about Eric?
That tends to happen when people talk. And you have started running since COVID. You were a COVID born runner, and GAA, I think, was your sports growing up. So from field sport, obviously very dynamic, to linear. Is there a lot to be said in terms of injury prevention for those who have spent time in team field sports with the kind of dynamic movement, as opposed to those who have just been linear? Or do we see more injuries from those who, like yourself, switch into running because, as you've mentioned, form might necessarily come into it, or a different, like those who've started in athletics clubs when they were 6, 7, 8 years of age have learned how to run properly and efficiently compared to the likes of myself and Sean who decide to just show up to marathons. Have you noticed anything in yourself, or is there anything to see which side of the fence is better?
There's a little bit of research now. I couldn't give you any specifics, but there's a little bit of research, I think, around people who take part in sports. I think it's without axial loading. So that's a type of loading basically through your body. Now, I'm not sure if it's if they're at a higher injury risk or a lower injury risk. So I'm not sure. I
put it all on black.
But in relation to like doing sports before and then changing into running, one thing that would kind of carry on would be like previous injuries you've sustained in your sport, say beforehand. Say like if you played rugby and you had like 2 ankle sprains and like a calf tear, that would probably have a knock-on effect into your running, and you'd be at possibly a greater risk of injury for either calf, ankle, or other types of injuries because of those previous injuries. So that can carry on through like historic sports. But like in relation to, you know, like there's so many factors in relation to injury risk and sport and running and stuff, but say field sports, there's so much more going on. And running is, when you think about it, it's quite simple. It's you and the ground, and you're running in a straight line. And really, we should be able to figure out why people are getting injured, and we can't.
Put a sensor on me and Sean.
Yeah.
Constantly injured.
It's mad, yeah.
There's a study done on running side. It's like 37 to 56% of people get injured annually when they run. And I've seen some as high as 74% of people runners get injured annually. It's so high compared to other sports. And like 50 to 75% of them put it down to overuse. 20 to 70% have reoccurring injuries down to that. And you're talking there about like rugby players with calf strain, stuff like that coming in. Is there a way to get like back? Do you think it's possible to get back to like zero in terms of that injury history doesn't matter as much, or is it always going to play a factor and that everyone's kind of unique as you go along? Like I don't know how that problem gets solved. Do you know what I mean?
Mm. Yeah. Like, I don't think you can kind of like reset the clock if that, you know, I think that history is always there, and so like a previous injury is a non-modifiable risk factor. So you can't change it. It's done. Like it's kind of there forever. There will typically be a history of tissue damage that takes really, really long to heal, like much longer than people think. So that kind of history is always there, and it's always going to be a factor in the whole host of things. But it doesn't mean that because you suffered this injury, you're going to get this injury. It's not definite, but it's just has to be considered in the mix. But I don't think you can really reset the clock and bring yourself back up to baseline. Now, you can definitely improve your strength and all that kind of stuff. But I think once that history is there, it's there.
So should you spend a lot of your time trying to improve that particular area? Or if you have, you're told you've got something, you're not as strong on one calf as the other or something like that, should you spend a lot of time in that? Or would you just be more of, at a certain point, you're just working more on general strength conditioning or general Pilates? Because you do both.
Yeah, we do. I actually don't teach them now at the minute, but we do some Pilates in the clinic that I work in. And I think they can, like, it can be really beneficial for athletes, for like other sports people, for non-sporting populations. I think if you have a history of injury, it's definitely important to consider that in any strength work that you do. But definitely a general kind of global strengthening program will be really important. But then with a focus on kind of any weaknesses or previous injuries that you've had, definitely to target those as well. Now, you won't always have the weakness that you had when you had the injury. Like, you can definitely improve on that. And you won't always have to be doing, say, calf rehab if you had this calf strain. You won't always have to be just absolutely tunnel vision on the calf. But to kind of bring yourself back up to the strength, at least to the other side, and then kind of focus on that global strength.
And in terms of the Pilates, if people are listening here now and they've gone from thinking I'm going to do this strength and conditioning and a little bit of CrossFit, and all of a sudden we're in Pilates, what is the key draw or the key benefits for athletes on a day where, so even triathletes or runners, when they have that cross training day where they, or strength and conditioning day, what is that if you were to put it into three bullet points about Pilates, what is the benefits of that, or you know, why should people be drawn to that?
I think Pilates is quite good because it's obviously, so it's a different type of load, so it's no impact. So if you're taking, I suppose, a rest day from your running, but you still want to be doing something with some sort of physical activity, it's a good alternative because it's reducing your load. So it's giving, like, it's deloading all of the load that you've sustained when you're training. So it's changing that type of loading. Then Pilates is quite focused on strengthening through really good ranges of motion. So it's kind of a combination between flexibility and strength. So improving your flexibility, but being strong through that whole range, which I think is really important. And then there's also like a huge focus on kind of core and like trunk stability, which is really important in running because it's a kind of a single leg sport where you're constantly on either one leg, like you're never on two legs. So that kind of core stability and trunk stability is really important to be able to absorb all that load on one leg, and keep yourself nice and strong in the center.
And that's one of the things I'm struggling with now is the core stability, glutes stability, strength in the pelvic floor. All of that is the areas I'm lacking in. So I'm signing up to two Pilates classes there as we speak, as you're talking to me.
They're definitely female dominant. So
not after this podcast. But it is great. And it's great to get that insight into the difference because we all know these things. We all know it's good to have good range of motion. And as we're getting older or we're doing more events, you feel a little bit stiffer and things. And Sean, through strength and conditioning and all the exercises, he has me doing all sorts of stuff in range of motion, which is really enjoyable. I like the challenge of it. And it feels really difficult at the start until everything starts to function and work as part of that one kind of system that we needed to.
And it can be even a nice, like, because it's, like, it's really focused on your breathing and you have to kind of center yourself and just like be a little bit present, and it lets you maybe de-stress a little bit and you can really focus on your breathing and focus on that strength through your range. So it's a really good change of like type of training, which can be really nice.
Ashley, what's your thoughts on muscles shutting on and off? Like, for example, I know social media can be very divisive, but some people talk about, like, Eric's talking about trunk stability. One that pops to mind is the glute med muscle. Is some people say it's very important for runners, and that when that's not working, the hamstrings can be overloaded. They can lead to fatigue and hamstring strains. And other people are like, if you are running, your glute med is working, muscles don't switch on and off. What would your thoughts be on that?
Yeah, definitely if you're running, your muscles are working. Like, you can't, they basically make your skeleton move. So you can't be running without them functioning. Now, it depends if they're functioning kind of most efficiently. So often the argument with the kind of hamstring glute relationship is that the hamstrings will be dominant. When you extend your hip comes backwards. That should be dominated really by your glute muscles. But a lot of the time your hamstring will kind of take over if your glutes are a bit, I'll use air quotes, kind of underactive. And your hamstring can kind of take over the role of that, which puts more strain through the hamstring, and then it might increase it's risk. So if you can work on improving kind of the activity of your glutes to take control of that hip extension movement, it'll deload your hamstring a little bit. They'll work kind of as a pair to do that whole movement rather than your hamstring dominating. And
does that happen more by isolating the glute as much as you can, like mini band work or Pilates work, or does that happen more through practice and running more?
It can probably be both. Like, definitely strengthening the glute, the glutes will help. A lot of the time, though, it's kind of a neural pathway wiring where just through habit or through whatever, your hamstring kind of fires first, and you have to nearly retrain your brain to get your glute working first. So we would often do, like in the clinic, say if someone is lying on their tummy, and get them to just squeeze their glute on their own and not their hamstring, just squeeze their glute and not their hamstring, and then start to lift their leg and get into that hip extension, but focusing on using the glute as the kind of primary muscle of that movement. So just kind of practicing that, but like doing it hundreds of times to try and rewire your whole kind of nervous system, that becomes then like the automatic default.
In your clinic, is this a common thing?
Yeah.
Where you would see something like that, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
That's why every time I've ever gone to a physio, they're always like, glute bridges.
Yeah. They're always weak.
Yeah.
It is mad. And it's something I have tried, and only in the last couple of weeks. It's great to have you on, because a lot of what you're saying is making sense to what has been happening to me in broken English over the last little while. But I'm understanding the concepts of particularly the mental aspect of. And it's really frustrating when you're trying to tell your hamstring to stop and one part to work. And you're like, I don't want to do it. Like, it is actually, it's probably the most frustrated I've been with a task that seems so easy in terms of trying to focus on a muscle to make it work and not let the hamstring take the load on a glute bridge.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh God, it's so hard. Yeah. Yeah.
it's absolutely bizarre. Like, and it's like, I don't know. It's just, it seems so simple and absolutely bizarre. Have you carried any of these niggles yourself? And is it hard to take your own advice at times?
Absolutely. Absolutely. worst patient ever. I never do it. I never give back to them. Running injuries, I've been quite lucky, to be honest. I would still call myself a footballer now. I actually haven't been back training this year yet, because just the PhD is a bit... it's kind of taken over. So it's, running is really attractive that way, that you can just run on your own schedule. But I've definitely had a good few injuries through football, but none really running. I picked up a couple of kind of niggly things, I thought, over COVID when I started running. And it was actually before the PhD. And I kind of was able to self-manage a little bit. And I was kind of reading some of the research around it and was able to kind of alter things a little bit. I had things going on my shins a little bit, but I haven't really had injuries where I've had to stop running for kind of a prolonged period of time or take breaks. Definitely in football, but in running, not yet. And hopefully, touch wood, not for a while.
So with your training towards the half marathon, are you doing much strength conditioning and Pilates work as well now? Not to put you in a spot compared to the running and stuff and your mileage and stuff like that, but what kind of training are you doing with your running?
So at the minute, I'm doing like 3 days running and 3 days gym. I suppose I definitely like going to the gym, and I would kind of have been that way anyway with football, and I like strength training and kind of power training and stuff. So that's kind of in my routine that I have kind of sustained that, but I definitely think it has helped with injuries and making me a better runner. Cause I'm not a runner. I'm 6 foot one. I'm tall, and I'm like, I hit the ground hard. So I'm not like naturally a runner. But I think it's definitely making me a little bit faster and a little bit better. And it's definitely more enjoyable that I feel that I'm getting fitter and stronger from the strength training.
Ashley, I'm not doing much about science, but if you're running 3 times a week, that makes you scientifically a runner.
Don Coffey, PhD. There's one element, I suppose, if you've listened to this now, you've got the fear of God that the toe that you stubbed off the door 3 years ago is going to come back to haunt you at kilometer 30 in the marathon. But what can people take as a positive from this in terms of looking forward into the training? So there's a lot of people who will listen to this, actually, who are going to, like you, maybe pick up their first half marathon. The Dublin series was announced. We know that in September, we're looking at a half marathon, Cork half marathon, and so many others around the country. What is a realistic way for someone to pick up a training plan to include strength and conditioning? And this is a very broad statement. Everyone is individual, and we understand that. But what is a realistic way for someone? You said 3 and 3 for you, but what's a realistic way, including stretching and strength and conditioning? What would a good plan look like to avoid these niggles?
So I wouldn't be able to speak on the running kind of on the running training side of stuff, but I think if you're to couple it with running, I think if you could do 2 strength training sessions a week, whether that be at home, in the gym, wherever it is, I think probably 2 sessions a week where you're getting a good like 45 minutes to an hour session and you're targeting kind of the main muscle groups. If you look at kind of the main injuries in running, things like Achilles tendinopathy at the back of your heel, like patellofemoral pain at the front of your knee, the side of your hip, if you're targeting the big muscle groups around those joints, I think you're doing well.
And for those of us who have heard many big words, what kind of exercises would you do to target these said muscle groups?
I may have experienced 2 of those 3 pains in the last week, so I'm really interested in writing these down.
I suppose Achilles stuff, you're looking at calf raises, you're looking at, but it depends kind of, so
We understand it comes with a big asterisk. Everyone is individual and injuries are individual, but for the general who may not, like myself, who I'm not carrying any injuries, but just trying to prevent, I suppose.
Yeah, I think, look, I think to be honest, in general, the calf is probably quite undertrained. I don't know if you follow the Irish physio on Instagram. He does a good bit of work around kind of calf strength. And I find him really good, but I think the calf can be generally undertrained. So loading the calf really well and loading the Achilles tendon and getting, because tendons like load, but they like the right type of load. So getting what's called eccentric load, so where you're really lowering kind of and lengthening the tendon, that's really important for tendon health to make it nice and springy and bouncy. I think that would be something definitely to incorporate in your training. I think probably hip control around kind of that glute med, the side of your hip, the outside of your hip, they can be quite troublesome for runners. So working on your hip strength, they'd probably be 2 ones that I would target kind of in general. Hip and calf.
It's like you've described pretty much every niggle I've had in any kind of stint of running. And Irish physio, if you're listening, give us €1 million or come on the podcast. But it's something that we don't pay attention to, and as well, and the calves always tend to lead to. So something I've always heard is if you have a problem in your knee, it tends to probably come from above. So it's something in your hip, it's something in your quad, it's hamstring, and likewise with the Achilles, it's more than likely something above, so probably the calf. Is that kind of true in that statement, that you can generally relate it to something that's not firing muscle-wise above?
It can be true. So kind of what we're looking at in relation to niggles is we kind of have this, you know, there's a kind of an example where, so say if you have this niggle in your hip, for example, but you continue to run, but you make some sort of subconscious change in your running technique to try offload your hip, but then all of a sudden you end up with a proper injury where you have to stop in your knee. But it was possibly the niggle that caused the change in your technique that offset the injury then at the knee. So injuries don't have to come from where they're painful, if you get me. So that, say that knee injury possibly came from the hip, you know, so they don't always have to come from the source, and there can be that kind of like adaptation or compensation effect where you're having a knock-on effect, or if there's a weakness in the joint above or below. So often with the knee, yes, it can come from the hip or from the ankle and the foot and below, and it meets in the knee. So definitely, like, it doesn't have to come from the site where you're injured, basically.
Is there a level threshold, or like a 1 to 10 scale of when you think people should and shouldn't run, or like you said there, something that's a pain 2 could just as easily turn into a pain 8 out of 10 if you go on it. So it all has to be catch the niggle early.
Yeah, that's probably the thing that we think is going to be important for preventing injuries is to listen to your body when you do have these niggles and to not ignore them and not run through them. Now, that doesn't mean that you have to stop running altogether, but maybe changing your load a little bit, whether that's running a little bit slower, running one day less, whether it's doing an extra like session in the gym or altering somehow just to offload that niggle and not ignore it, push it to the back of your head and just run through it, because possibly it might come back kind of to bite you in a more extreme way.
Let's say we're further down the running continuum here. We're near short-term injury, long-term injury, and we'll have this link up on the show notes there because it's class what you've gone through in this. And you do have a bad injury or as you put here, a severe discomfort or a high sharp pain or something like that. One of the things people go to straight away would be the RICE principle, rest, ice, compression, elevation. What's your thoughts on that, particularly ice?
I think there's a bit of an argument for ice in like acute injuries. So when they just happen, that there's an argument that ice can kind of stop the healing process or delay it. And it's kind of that natural healing process that should happen. But from a clinical perspective, people find ice really beneficial. And if you can get subjective pain relief from ice, I think use it. I would advocate for it. I think if people find it useful, but it's not like just because you didn't put ice on something doesn't mean it's going to make anything worse or, you know, it's not going to be make or break. But I think if you can get some pain relief from it, if it can get you out of pain, I think use it. Yeah.
Speaking of that, actually, because I saw another Ackerman, I swear I didn't make this up, Peace and Love was the other Ackerman to RICE. So just to go to people that haven't heard it, the piece is protection, elevation, A is avoid anti-inflammatories, which I'm getting to, C, compression, and E, education. And then the love is load, optimism, big word I can't pronounce that, vascularization.
Doing great, sweetie.
Thank you. I'm going to edit that part out. I'm not really experienced, but I'm going to get back to the A. Avoid anti-inflammatories, because you just said on the ice there that it's easy to, that if it provides comfort, take it. Is that the same for anti-inflammatories? You wouldn't recommend avoiding it, or is that case by case?
I think it's a similar argument that like anti-inflammatories can block that kind of initial phase of inflammation, which is natural, and it basically helps the healing process. And by taking anti-inflammatory, you block that and kind of delay it. So I think, again, it's kind of like the evidence-based practice where you have to be guided by evidence, and that's what evidence is saying, so be guided by it. But also, if a person is in significant discomfort and if an anti-inflammatory can reduce that discomfort, you know, then maybe take one.
Is there a timing window on any of that, do you think? Or is it like, the other way they say sometimes 24 hours, 48 hours for ice or anti-inflammatories that you should or shouldn't? Or is it just that person's feeling pain, that person's swelling, let's get the ice and anti-inflammatories in?
That initial phase of inflammation is kind of the first, I suppose, within the first 48 hours, that's kind of all happening. And then that really quite acute initial inflammation phase kind of calms down a little bit. Now, this is, I suppose, in relation, say things like an ankle sprain, which aren't kind of overly common in running. These are more kind of gradual onset injuries. So the argument is a little bit different for running injuries because they typically happen progressively over time. Whereas like acute injuries like ankle sprains, they're quite quick and sharp and there's a big inflammation and like loads of swelling. That's kind of the argument in relation to ice and anti-inflammatories, where you're going to try to block that and you shouldn't block that. So with running injuries, it mightn't be as appropriate of an argument, I suppose.
Just so, everyone listening that got that to like taking a couple of Nurofen and stuff before doing a marathon, they're like, do I rethink this or not? Not that we're condoning doing that.
No, we're not. No.
You just hear stories. More likely off the podcast, actually, than on.
I ain't saying nothing. And do you think, in terms of, obviously, again, it's an Olympic year, when we're looking at our high performance athletes who seem to get the injuries as well, is there, I suppose, an element, in the research, you're looking at the average Joes, myself, Sean, yourself, who take up the running, we get our niggles, and then you look at the elite performance athlete, to what scale is it a difference, or are we all just the same, just operating on different levels, and the same kind of long-lasting, it's repetitiveness, those niggles will still be the same in the elite as they are in the average? Or are you looking at two different sciences in terms of an elite athlete versus ourselves?
Tough one. I suppose at the end of the day, we're all human, so we're all kind of the same. But there's so much effort that goes into elite sport and elite athletes, and everything is so fine-tuned and so closely monitored that you can kind of say, well, how are we anywhere near them? Like, they're just, you know, they're so elite and they're so, like, everything is so monitored. So possibly, like, you would, I suppose, expect them to be at less risk of injury or injuries to be managed more appropriately. But they still get injured, and like, injuries happen. I think it's like Sean, you said, it's one nearly one in every two runners gets injured every year. And that's kind of the stat. Now, they kind of take that with a pinch of salt, because loads of things affect that figure. But I think we are all human at the end of the day, and we are all at risk of injury, no matter if you're elite or, you know,
the average Joe. Well, I suppose they probably have people like you telling them when to change their load and when to up to it to keep them on that trajectory and matching their schedules and stuff. There's a lot goes into the elite athlete, I suppose, compared to put on the shoes and just go for a run and see how we go.
And like, it's their job, and they have, you know, they can be doing all their strength training and doing everything that they can to help themselves, whereas people don't have the luxury of that all the time. And, you know, you have to be able to balance things like kids and work and commuting and just not wanting to go to the gym on a Friday night is grand, you know.
I seen on I think it was on Twitter, I think it's Dr. Steve Magnus, he talks about the higher elite people, they only do, like, they might only do really intense training. It's more specific to running, like, once a week, whereas the average Joe, like myself, would try and train high intensities 2 to 3 times a week. And you talk about excessive loading being one of the key reasons for injury. Do you think people do too much high intensity training that would lead to that? Or is that...
I think it's all relative. And like, I suppose I talk about loading as a kind of a umbrella term. Like, loading can be distance, frequency, intensity, you know, it's not just like, whereas intensity is obviously kind of only one aspect of loading. So kind of overloading in general is kind of all of those things, whereas intensity is just one aspect of that.
Is there one of those that sticks out the most when you think of loading for injury?
I think mileage would probably be the one that, say, when people present in the clinic, it's that they've upped their mileage. They've jumped from a 40, say, kilometer mile week to a 70, and you're like, whoa, you know, it's a big jump. So that would kind of be probably the biggest thing that's seen in from my perspective in a clinic, is probably mileage. But like, intensity, like, those kind of high intensity sessions can be quite demanding. So need more recovery probably in the meantime. So look, from a performance perspective, I can't really speak on that, and I don't really know. But injury wise, it's hard to kind of say how many a week to do or that kind of thing. I think it's like, it's just all relative, and if it's what you like to do, you know, do it, but make sure you're recovering.
When you're not doing that list of things I had in the intro, and you're scrolling through Instagram, and obviously you probably follow like-minded people and stuff, or people in your field, is there anything that comes up an injury where you're like, my God, if I have to, like, this stupid myth just won't go away about injury that you constantly see with runners? Is there something like that that pops to mind?
On social media,
or anywhere.
Anywhere.
Even if me and Sean have said it in the last 30 minutes.
Yeah, if they're like, these two idiots brought this up.
I think, like, the one thing, say, even, like, in the clinic, people say, I had this niggle 6 weeks ago and now it's getting worse. And you're like, well, why didn't you come to me 6 weeks ago? You know, that's probably one thing. People, like, runners ignore pain. And if I think things can probably be addressed quicker and more appropriately if they don't ignore it.
Yeah, so, you dressed two idiots there. Yeah. I'm guilty as charged in that one.
It'll be okay. It goes away on its own. But it is something, and it's so good to have you on, because it is something we said we would take more seriously. Sean had bad injuries last year that put him out for a couple of weeks. I was feeling like there was something just not right, and went and figured out there was a lot of compensation going on from my neck all the way down. That's been rectified now. We're getting to a stage where it's only a once a month checkup now, that we just keep going to make sure we're still on the right track. But a lot of people are avoiding that, and a lot of people are struggling to find people who can put them on this right trajectory. So what do you recommend for people who are probably listening, they're feeling a niggle, and they're like, right, where do I go and who do I talk to? Do we just give out your phone number here? Or no, in general, what do people do to find the best source, or those who they can trust to kind of put them on the right path and understand that they like to keep running and want to keep training?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing. Get someone you trust. Now, look, that can be easier said than done, but like, if you go to an AT or to a physio or to whatever type of clinician, I think if you trust them and you can be honest with them, and they can be honest with you, that, you know, you can maintain your training as much as you can, but addressing the issues at hand and figuring out what's causing the issues, that would be the most important thing. I think getting someone you trust, if you feel that they're not addressing the issue, I think don't be afraid to go see someone else or to look down a different path, try alternative stuff, and like talk to them about it and be like, well, I was thinking of this, like, what about this? And have them explain to you and open every avenue if you think there's something that's causing your injuries or causing, you know, these things, to just explore everything. Don't be shy about, like, or don't be kind of like, don't be tough about it either. Don't ignore it, and, you know, that kind of thing. But I think get it addressed is kind of the important thing. And look, like, you can't be affording to go to see someone every week, every niggle you have. That's not reasonable either. But if you can get something where you can be able to self-manage it for as long as possible, and you can be educated around it using research to guide your practice and to guide your rehab and injury prevention stuff, I think that'll be really important too.
Ashling, where can people keep up with your research and the 27 gadgets you're going to put on people to see their injury prevention stuff?
So our study is called the DCU Risk Study, so RISC. It stands for Running Injury Surveillance Centre. So we have probably an inactive Twitter at the minute, but it should be on the DCU website, and we'll be starting recruitment hopefully in the next few months, looking for runners if anyone is involved. Obviously, we're based in Dublin, but because we'll be collecting data from you, it's on your own schedule anywhere around the country, like, you can take part. So you'll have to come to DCU probably for an assessment. We have a big... So it's called a VICON system. It's like a motion analysis system where we can check people's running gait. We might do stuff like that, VO2 max, and loads of different kind of incentives to hopefully get people on board. But looking at monitoring their running load will be the big thing.
And is this being backed by DCU, or is this by who we've mentioned at the start of the podcast?
Insight. Yeah. So it's both. So Insight are a large kind of data analytics company. So there's loads of different multi disciplines involved in it, between like data scientists, computer scientists, us, biomechanists, all these people. Yeah, so it's great. It's a really cool kind of multi-disciplinary
team.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely brilliant. I'd love to recommend Sean for it, but I think he'll skew your data a little bit too much. So hopefully we get some better applicants to wear the devices for you. But
anyone, once you run, we'll
take it. Half the stuff you talked about, Ashley, in the last couple of minutes about trying to be tough and getting through the injuries, stuff like that, I feel personally attacked. But apart from that, I really enjoyed this episode of the podcast. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, lads.
Ashling, it has been brilliant having you on. We have learned so much about niggles, injuries, learning to listen to our body, and understanding. It's great to understand the research and the reasons why we're seeing the Instagram reels and we're seeing the posts about X, Y, and Z and all of these And it's nice to talk to someone to help guide us. And those listening, start listening to your body. Start listening to Aisling. Put this on repeat every time you feel a twinge. And start to look after ourselves. And thanks so much for having you on. We hope to have you back on again. Let us know how the research is going, and guide us more as throughout the year, if you're happy to have us and interfere with your great studies. thank you so much for coming on.
No worries, Ed. Thanks so much.
And that's it for this week's episode of the Any Given Day podcast. Myself, Aisling, and Eric. Take care.